Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week we read Luke chapter 13, verses 1 to 9 and 31 to 35, which includes Jesus' discussion of the causes of suffering, the parable of the fig tree, and Jesus' lament over the city of Jerusalem. We wrestle with the popular theology that bad things happen to the worst sinners, and with Jesus' apparent counterclaim that all of us, in fact, are sinners who deserve punishment. We ponder Jesus' parable of the fig tree, which offers a model for nurturing rather than threatening people into repentance. And we encounter Jesus' tender lament over Jerusalem, the city he wishes to embrace, but which is so enthralled with its own power that it cannot receive his prophetic voice. There's a lot going on in this one, y'all. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I'm good. How are you?
I am also good. So this week we're in Luke chapter 13.
Indeed.
And last time we were a couple chapters back in the story of the Samaritan, who is sometimes called good, and Mary and Martha. And so couple of chapters worth of stuff has happened in between there. Is there anything in particular that you think we need to pull out in order to make sense of this text today?
So Jesus has talked about some big things. One of my favorites was this question, how to pray.
Yeah.
I really liked the question of how to pray. And this ongoing sense that we've had, I think, throughout the gospel in some ways of you all are focusing on the wrong things. You know, you're focusing on these surface level things, whether that is ritual appropriateness or care for your body and your comfort, or even maintaining peace when that peace means passivity.
Yeah.
You know, there really is a to me, like jarring, somewhat alarming sense that, you know, you have to choose a side.
Yeah.
You know, and whoever's not with me is against me.
This is also an extension of that. If you remember back in chapter 9, verse 51, there was a transition from the Galilean ministry to the Judean ministry. And it said Jesus set his face to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been on a journey since chapter 9, although we haven't actually covered a lot of it in the narrative lectionary texts.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesus has set his face and is headed toward Jerusalem. And there is this sense, you know, it's like you're on your way to Mordor, right? There's this sense that big things are happening at the end of this journey.
Yeah.
And so that's always sort of hanging in the background. So this, you've got to choose a side, is getting amplified as we move toward Jerusalem.
Yes.
Okay. So picking up then in Luke chapter 13, verse 1. Some who were present on that occasion told Jesus about the Galileans whom Pilate had killed while they were offering sacrifices. He replied, "Do you think the suffering of these Galileans proves that they were more sinful than all the other Galileans? No, I tell you, but unless you change your hearts and lives, you will die just as they did. What about those 18 people who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them? Do you think that they were more guilty of wrongdoing than everyone else who lives in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you change your hearts and lives, you will die just as they did." First, can we just talk about, like, what on earth is this thing about Pilate killing people while they're offering sacrifices?
So when I read it initially, I read it pretty literally, not just that they had been killed while offering a sacrifice, but that their blood had actually been involved in some way.
Yeah, the NRSV translation is different, I think, isn't it? It's like he mingled their blood.
Yeah.
I like that translation.
Yeah, he mingled their blood with their sacrifices.
Yeah.
So then I went down this whole road in my mind about why would you do that in particular? Like not just the cruelty of killing them as they're offering a sacrifice, but the way in which that would desecrate the sacrifice.
Like it's different. Like if Pilate had just killed some Galileans like on the road,
mm-hmm.
like that's very different than killing people in the temple such that their blood and their sacrifice's blood is all spilled there together. Like, this is a violation of some, not just a violation of these people, but of the sanctity of the temple. I think that part is right.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense.
Now, the text just tells us that these folks are telling Jesus about it.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of, like, are they just, like, informing him, do you think? Or do you think this is a test that they're putting toward him, or just a question that they're asking him? Like, how do you read their tone or their intent in that question?
I guess I came at the question slightly differently, but if they're telling this story, but not, they're not asking any question about it.
Yeah.
I mean, in some way, it could just be that it's sort of a scary, kind of titillating story that you tell.
Yeah.
Maybe because you're not sure what the implications of it are, but maybe because they want Jesus to be aware that they're all in danger by living any kind of life of faith.
I like that. I really like that because, you know, I had initially read this as they were putting this to him as a test. But the more we're talking about it, the more I think that I'm wrong about that, and that they're just telling him because they're there with him. He's a wise teacher, and this is something that they want to think about.
But it's so interesting to see his response to them. Do you think that happened to them because they were sinners? Because that's not what that was.
Yeah.
So that implies to me either that maybe they did.
Yeah.
Or at least Jesus thought they did.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a pretty common way of thinking in, I mean, you can correct me about this, but my understanding is this is a fairly common way of thinking in the context of first century Judaism, coming out of sort of Deuteronomy and other places where one's outcomes are related to one's behaviors. And so you say, if this tragedy befalls these people, it must have been because of something that they did.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is taking this opportunity to engage that framework, even though the people didn't at least self-evidently bring that framework with them. But maybe it was just such a common framework that Jesus kind of assumed that that's where they were coming from.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think especially the question of how it could happen to them at the moment of sacrifice. Like, were they doing something wrong at that moment? Jesus' response is so fascinating.
Like, it is.
They did not get killed because they were worse sinners. But I'm telling you, if you don't repent, you will. So sort of it like flips on its head at first, this idea that you're punished, like that you die because of your sins.
Yeah.
But then it flips it back over again, you know, and says but that will happen to you. That's not what happened here, but that is what will happen to you.
Yeah, so Jesus starts out to say, like, are you trying to think about this as these folks who were killed are worse sinners than you are? And he kind of relieves that sort of like the Deuteronomic connection, saying, no, there's nothing here about, like, this could have happened to anybody. And then he makes that move that you're talking about, which is the flip, which is to say, and really what's amazing is it hasn't happened to you yet, right? Like, that's kind of what he says when he says, I tell you, unless you change your hearts and lives, you will die just as they did. Is sort of saying, like, everybody, like, if what we're going by here is, you know, sinfulness, then I think what he's saying is everybody kind of deserves to die. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is not that these folks died, but that you didn't. And it's going to happen to you, like sometime between now and then, like it's going to happen to you too. Is that how you read that?
I mean, yes, I think that's right. I just think it's challenging for me that I feel like Jesus both says that's not the system at play here.
Yeah.
But it also is about to be.
Yeah.
You know, but I like the way you put it better. That's much easier to take in, is sort of that what's surprising is not that they died. It's that you didn't.
Now in verse 4, Jesus adds, so we've already got this thing about Pilate killing people in the temple, and Jesus then adds a whole different scenario, which is 18 people killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them. And then he just kind of repeats the same line of questioning. Do you think this is because they were worse than everybody else? No, I tell you. So what does the tower falling on people add, or like why does he bother to tell that second example?
The first thought that comes to my mind is that it seems even more random.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing if they were in the temple offering sacrifice, they were in the midst of some elevated sacred activity. I don't know, set apart from just, you know, your everyday walking down the street in Southwest Jerusalem. But a tower falling on you, that is some randomness.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, I mean, I don't know, like the first folks were Galileans. And the second group are just people near the Tower of Siloam. That makes me think they might be people from Jerusalem, or at least people from Judea, who are not sort of out of their place. And I don't know if that matters, that, you know, Galileans are like, I don't know, I was going to say, they're like tourists, or they're, you know, they're like people from the flyover country who have wandered into New York City. Like, there's this kind of like, they didn't know what they were getting into in the big city. But now we've got people who are actually used to being in the city who are still getting killed for totally random reasons. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it matters that whether they're Galilean or not?
That question makes me want to know more about the people who are asking Jesus these questions. Like, if the people who are talking to Jesus right now, if we think that they're Judeans, which I guess seems likely if we think he's in Judea at this point, then it brings it a little closer to home for them.
So Jesus, in that sense, is trying to bring people close to, like, the hovering nature of death. And that line, unless you change your hearts and lives, or unless you repent, you will die just as they did. Like, it's only a matter of time till this happens to you.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus is, I mean, if they were looking for comfort from him, he has not offered them comfort.
No, I don't think he's offered them comfort at all. I still am struggling a little bit with the juxtaposition of, well, I guess he doesn't say that they weren't killed because they were sinners. He's just saying they weren't any worse than you.
Yeah.
Okay, I stand corrected then. He's not actually saying this is a random thing that happened. I mean, it is random in that they were chosen among all the other sinners for this fate, but as long as Jesus wants to hold up the possibility that one could repent and avoid this situation, then we have to somehow say it's not totally random. Like, there is some implied sinfulness in the people who were killed in these ways.
Yeah. There is a connection between sin and tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that you've been thinking of it as mostly we live in a state where we are righteous enough that tragedy is not likely to befall us. And so the tragedy is the exception.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is saying, actually, if we were going on that system, like, everybody deserves to die at any moment. And the miracle is that you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Jesus, in his way, tries to clarify what he's talking about by telling a parable in verses 6 to 9. So let's look at that parable, and then we can see if that parable helps us figure out what's going on here.
Okay.
Jesus told this parable. A man owned a fig tree planted in his vineyard. He came looking for fruit on it and found none. He said to his gardener, "Look, I've come for fruit on this fig tree for the past 3 years, and I've never found any. Cut it down. Why should it continue depleting the soil's nutrients?" The gardener responded, "Lord, give it one more year, and I will dig around it and give it fertilizer. Maybe it will produce fruit next year. If not, then you can cut it down."
This always makes me think of those, like, educator memes that say something like, if a plant doesn't grow, you don't blame the plant. Well, Jesus is blaming the plant. Like,
oh, like at the very end there? Yeah.
Like the idea that if a fig tree isn't growing, you would cut it down. I don't know. Like the point of the meme is supposed to be like, as the gardener does, like, let's change the environment. Like, it's not the plant's fault it's not growing. There's something in its environment that's causing the problem.
So we've got two characters in this. I mean, we've got three characters. We've got the fig tree, which is oddly a character, which I think you're right. Like, the onus seems to be on the fig tree that eventually it needs to produce some fruit. Then we've got a man who's fed up with the fig tree. And then we've got a gardener who says, look, let me tend to it a little more and we'll see. Like, the gardener wants to give it more time. So, like, I think before, like, one of the ways that I read parables, we've talked about this before, is before we sort of say, like, who's who in the parable, we just try to think about, like, what is the position of those three characters, and then maybe we try to relate it to other things. So maybe we can approach it that way.
Yeah, good.
So what do you make of the dynamic, I guess, between the man and the gardener?
That's such an interesting question, taking the fig tree out of it, because I think of both of them as having a relationship to the fig tree.
Well, we can leave the fig tree in there.
Well, I mean, I think of the Okay, but I want to try to answer your question first. The man and the gardener, it makes me think of like stories of Moses or Abraham intervening in moments where God is angry and trying to advocate for just like slow your roll.
Yeah.
Slow down. Yeah, like the gardener is caring for the fig tree and says, let me try one more thing. Like, yeah. Let's see if we can make this work.
No, I love that. And so the gardener has this sort of, tender relationship with the fig tree. Might not be exactly right, but he's got more compassion. Like, his default is, let's give this tree another go.
Yeah, he has some investment in this tree.
It is interesting that the man who owns the fig tree, like, it's already been 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably he's come and he's seen this fig tree 3 times now, every season, and it's never producing fruit. And, you know, the first 2 times, he's like, okay, I'll give it one more year. I'll give it one more year. So it's not that he has had no patience. It's just that he has reached the limit of his patience before the gardener does.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the gardener seems to take some, I don't know, is the gardener taking responsibility? Or, like, what he says is, let me play around in there a little bit. Let me see if I can tend it better. Let me see if I can give it more fertilizer. And then we'll see what it does. So in some way, the gardener is, I don't know if he's taking responsibility for the tree's lack of fruitfulness, but he at the very least thinks he can maybe nurture it into producing fruit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he thinks he can have some impact on this situation.
Now, I guess one question to ask about this parable is, does it connect in your head to other stories biblically?
I'm going to go with yes. Well, let me just ask you, do you have something in mind that they might be reading?
Well,
the story
I have
through?
Two thoughts in mind, but I don't know. I don't entirely know what I think about either one of them.
Mm.
The first one is a text that you and I talked about last year, which is Isaiah chapter 5, in which you've got a person coming to a garden who says, I planted this garden. I thought it was going to produce grapes, but it produced wild grapes. And so I'm just going to let it go. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop tending it and let it shrivel. And that parable, I think, turns out to be like God is the gardener, Israel is the garden, and the gardener's just done.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, when you read, there's a guy with a vineyard, because it's a little weird to have a fig tree in a vineyard, I think. But anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the notion of vineyard puts my head in that space. And when he sees that it's not producing any fruit, I think, oh no, like this is God in his vineyard of Israel and God is done.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this other character who does not show up in Isaiah, who shows up here and is like, hang on a second, let's give it a little more time. So it's almost like that Isaiah text got another character who has a little more patience.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that I was reading is not Hebrew Bible, but that passage you and I talked about a few weeks ago where John at the baptism is saying the axe is already at the root of the tree. And so that was anticipating this kind of cutting down of the forest because there's no fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And then here it's okay. The axe is like leaning up against the wall of the garden now, right? We put the axe back in the tool shed. We didn't get rid of the axe, but we're not going to use it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, I mean, I think those are both really helpful ways to think about it. And it's, I have so much trouble reading parables not to like quickly assign, you know, characters to the different roles. So I'm going to try not to do that.
I mean, at some point you've got to do that. So
yeah,
I think
at some
like,
point you have to do that. But it is in the texts leading up to this, many of which were not in the narrative lectionary, there is this sense of urgency about like, you know, you must decide like now you have to decide what you're doing. And so it's, I guess, surprising to me in some way, in a good way, to have this text in here that acknowledges that there's a problem, that there hasn't been fruit yet. But also, you know, in the end, it seems like there's going to be one more chance.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's right. Like the gardener has, and mercy's kind of a funny word to use for a fig tree, but you know what I mean? Like the gardener manages to intervene, but only for a limited time. So it's not the case that the fig tree is just, it's fine if you never produce fruit. Yeah. It's, you've still got to produce fruit, but we're going to give you another chance.
Right. And we're going to give you every, not just water and sun, but like, we're going to put fertilizer all around you. Like, we're going to give you every opportunity here, but it is limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you connect this back to the previous story, so now the fig tree becomes somehow representative of the people and what kind of lives they're living. Like, here, repentance is about, you know, changing your hearts and lives, as the CEB translates it. And so the point then seems to be, you've got a little time to turn yourself around, but you don't have forever.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is interesting is, like, you can browbeat people into changing their lives, right? like, what is wrong with you? I'm going to beat you up until you change.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow this parable far enough, that's not the gardener's approach. The gardener is, I'm going to nurture you into changing your life.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you still can't do it, I'm going to chop you down. So, like, I don't know quite. Like, it's a lot better than just, like, I'm going to stand here with an axe until you produce a fig.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that's interesting, that there's this sort of, I'm going to nurture you, but there's a limit to my nurturance, or something like that.
Yeah, it's a very, I feel like that's a difficult posture to assume as humans, that, like, we're invested enough to truly take a nurturing stance that is time limited.
Yeah.
You know?
The other connection that, for me, between this passage and that baptism story back in chapter 3 is, we talked about in that story how John is preaching, like, there's the axe is at the root of the tree, like, God is coming to chop you down. And we asked whether Jesus is really like that in the Gospel of Luke. And to me, this parable kind of puts us back in that conversation, where John is representing a vision of God that is sort of like the vineyard owner in this passage, where time is up and I've got my axe and I'm ready to go. And then maybe Jesus is more like the gardener, representing a vision of God where there is nurturing patience with a time stamp. It expires at some point. And so we've got these sort of competing visions of what is God's judgment like that have been kind of following us through this gospel. And maybe this passage is suggesting that Jesus leans into the more merciful, more nurturing way, but that Jesus' patience, like, eventually runs out too.
No, I love that. And I appreciate, again, I always appreciate when you slow me down on these parables, but my initial inclination had been to read Jesus as the frustrated man, because Jesus is quite frustrated with the community of people around him. But I think it does make a lot more sense if we read Jesus and God as two separate characters in this parable. So God is the man and Jesus is the gardener.
Okay, so then the narrative lectionary skips down to the end of chapter 13 in verses 31 to 35. At that time, some Pharisees approached Jesus and said, "Go, get away from here, because Herod wants to kill you." Jesus said to them, "Go tell that fox, 'Look, I'm throwing out demons and healing people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I will complete my work. However, it's necessary for me to travel today, tomorrow, and the next day, because it's impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem.'" And then Jesus says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who were sent to you, how often I have wanted to gather your people just as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you didn't want that. Look, your house is abandoned. I tell you, you won't see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessings on the one who comes in the Lord's name.'" Okay, this passage to me is complicated in all sorts of ways. It is sort of a, you know, that movement that started back in 951 of Jesus setting his face towards Jerusalem.
Yeah.
This to me is sort of a kind of a clear articulation of, like, what does that mean? So anyway, the way we get into it, though, is that some Pharisees come and warn Jesus that Herod is trying to kill him. What?
Yeah.
What is happening there, do you think?
I mean, okay, so it strikes me that the last section that we read and this section both start with mention of some kind of outside danger.
Yeah.
You know, Pilate and Herod. I mean, okay, you could read the Pharisees as genuinely having some concern for Jesus's well-being. On the face of it, that seems to be what it says.
Yeah.
But they have had a tense relationship with Jesus.
Yeah. The Pharisees are almost never seen in a positive light. Maybe they're never seen in a positive light in the Gospel of Luke. They're pretty much always oppositional figures. So it is like, are you opening the possibility that they're like being disingenuous here or something?
I don't know if it's totally disingenuous. I mean, I think that you could see it as they're trying to distract Jesus from his mission, whether it's true or not that Herod wants to kill him, that they're, you know, they think that that will be something that will get him to stop doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
How do you read it?
I tend to read it as these disciples are testing whether Jesus, like they're trying to get Jesus, they're trying to freak Jesus out so he quits doing what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're making threats that have no real basis in reality, hoping it will intimidate Jesus into stopping this mission mm-hmm. that he's on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you make of Jesus? He says, I have to go to Jerusalem, I'm paraphrasing, because it's impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem. What do you do with that?
First, I just have to say, I could not love Jesus's response more. He's basically like, well, I'm busy right now. I have like today and tomorrow I'm booked. And so
yeah,
I'll send you a Google invite for when we can. Okay. I mean, it's just so interesting coming from that. My general mindset towards Jerusalem is this, like, this place of elevated holiness.
Yeah.
And we know that there is, speaking ritually, there is danger with holiness, right? Anytime things are sort of elevated in that way, there is danger. But here it's like a different kind of danger. Like it's, but maybe also because of that sense of elevated holiness, like that, I almost want to say it drives people to a little madness. I don't know. Like the level of intensity at which religious discourse is happening mm-hmm. in Jerusalem is just unlike any other place. And so there are dangers. Like it's the crucible, right? And so it is both critical to get there and very dangerous to be there.
I love that. And I think that's exactly right. And I would also add in there, like, this is the center not only of religious authority, but also of political mm-hmm. power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And often those two things are mingled together. So the what's religious and what's political are not clearly divided.
Yes.
And so if you start mucking around in religion and politics in the center of power, mm-hmm. which prophets do, that's going to be dangerous for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it has always been that way. So some people read this as, like, you know, I mean, this can be interpreted anti-Jewishly, right? Like, Jews always kill their prophets. But I don't think that's a great reading of it. I think what it's saying is the political and religious elites always kill their prophets. And we can mm-hmm. look back in the Hebrew Bible and we can see, you know, Amos gets threatened and Jeremiah gets threatened and Elijah gets threatened. Like, there is a pattern that is not necessarily the killing of prophets, but certainly mm-hmm. the threat of death is there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not because Jews always kill their prophets. It's because the people in power don't like it when people mess with their power. And so prophets get killed in the center of power.
Yeah. No, I mean, not all prophets, but many prophets, their whole job is to upset the apple cart.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the people who are on the outside of the power structures are going to be more willing to do that and more interested in what the outcome is going to be, even if their interest is self-interest.
Yeah.
Whereas the people who are at the center of things and in power and politically or religiously are not going to want to do that and are going to have the means have the means to stop it, although that's not quite how this story ends. But they have the means for violence. You know, they have the means for intimidation. And that's, you know, as you always say, like, that's still true.
Yeah.
Have nothing to do with Jerusalem. Like, that is still true.
That's exactly right. Okay, so Jesus has a little lament here over Jerusalem. And I mean, a lot depends on how you read Jesus's tone here. But Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And then he says, I've wanted to gather your people just as a hen gathers her chicks, but you didn't want that. And so that's such an interesting image, that the sorrow, the tenderness, the like sense of rejection.
Mm.
What do you do with Jesus in this lament over Jerusalem?
I mean, the question running through my head is this really, is this Jesus speaking as God?
You know, to me, I think that's a pretty good way of reading what's happening here. I mean, Jesus is depicted as a prophet in the Gospel of Luke. Obviously, he's, you know, being envisioned as the Son of God in the Gospel of Luke. And so in my mind, this is one of the places where those voices kind of merge and that I've wanted to gather you. I mean, I think Jesus is having compassion, but I think Jesus's compassion is reflecting sort of God's compassion for Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And there's a sense in which, you know, what's being said is, I want to gather the people of Jerusalem in, but Jerusalem itself doesn't want the people gathered.
That's so interesting.
Say more about that.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about sort of the systems that we're all a part of, and that if we can break ourselves free from the systems, we may know very well that we should be, you know, looking for shelter at our mother hen. But we get stuck in this structure, like the structure that is represented here by Jerusalem, and it prevents us from doing that.
That's kind of where I'm headed to, I think, is Jerusalem is kind of representing the structure of the city, the government and the religious structures like we were talking about. And the people are kind of being manipulated and trapped by that. And Jesus, God, wants to gather them in like a mother hen gathers the chickens, but the, you know, the city has a grip on them and won't let them go.
Right. Like, I almost want to read like Jerusalem as Wall Street or, you know, whatever would be a parallel to power structures.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you, I mean, this entirely in keeping with the Hebrew Bible tradition too, right? Where oftentimes it's the monarchy that is gone astray and the people are misled. Like the people are also doing wrong, but it's because their leadership has misled them. And so they get punished for something that, you know, they got manipulated or coerced into doing. I sort of read this in that light.
Yeah.
And then this last verse, your house is abandoned. You won't see me until the time comes when you say blessings on the one who comes in the Lord's name. Any thoughts about what Jesus is doing there?
I don't know what specifically Jesus is referring to, but my sort of general read of it is, I won't come till you're ready. Like until you're ready to say, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. But I don't know if that's actually true to what plays out.
Yeah, and then I think there's, in my mind, that last verse is a sort of a messianic, like the when Jesus returns, that's going to be when you are able to recognize who I am. But until then, you're not going to get it.
Ah, Jerusalem, Jerusalem.
Okay, Amy, so that brings us to the time in our conversations where we try to think about what these passages or this passage might have to say to contemporary people. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, it's sort of like a continuation of a theme that we've been talking about for several weeks now. But the idea that what Jesus is asking of people is not a polite faith and that peace is not going to look like everyone getting along and singing kumbaya together, which for me really raises the question of when Jesus teaches elsewhere to love everyone, to love your neighbor, what do we mean? What does that mean? Like, you know, that love doesn't mean everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that figuring out how to live in community with people that you disagree with, I don't know. It's really hard to figure out when you sort of say like, we have to, you know, quote unquote, tolerate each other and keep the peace for the name of peace. And when love has to look like something different. And I think that it is always a question of whether whatever that difference, whatever looking different means, when it truly comes from love and when it doesn't. I mean, as I'm listening to myself talk, I'm like, oh my God, this teaching, what I'm saying could be used in so many bad ways.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to say about that. But I just feel a lot of like personal accountability reading this text for my own relationship to God, whatever I conceive that to mean, and how that might look really different from other people's, and it might cause a lot of disruption. And that's all as it just is. Like, that's all part of the plan for it to be that way. And I don't like that. I don't like conflict. And I want love and peace to look really, not necessarily polite, but patient. Love is patient. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm struggling. I'm struggling with the tension of those messages.
Yeah.
Clearly. I'm struggling.
Now, I think that is an important struggle. And I think you're right on about what this text is doing. And it puts me back in the mindset of, you know, all the way back from the time that Mary finds out she's pregnant and she sings in the Magnificat, you know, he has pulled down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. There's mm-hmm. been this theme of conflict, and it is specifically conflict about power structures. And it seems to be that, you know, that love means something like solidarity with the poor, and that oftentimes is going to anger the wealthy or the powerful and the powerful. And there's the conflict. And so in that gives you a little bit of a guardrail, at least, to say, like, you don't just pick fights for the sake of fights, but you are always in solidarity with the poor and seeking the well-being of the oppressed. And that's going to cause conflict. But it's the conflict, you know, the conflict is born out of loving your neighbor more than you love wealth and power, which can still be used in all kinds of ways, right? Like, what does it mean to stand in solidarity with the poor? But at least that gives us sort of a starting point.
No, I think that's right. And I think it can be extended even further to if we have this idea that Jerusalem represents in this text, you know, the general power structures that we're all sort of plugged into, that we can love the people who are stuck in those power structures, who do have power, and honestly believe it is in their best interest and in the best interest of, you know, humanity as a whole that the power structure is put aside. But that looks really different than how we often think about love looking.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. This text is bringing me to, I've gotten focused on the parable, which is not actually where I was focused before we started talking, but on this issue of, well, there's a couple things there. One, on this conversation that we're having right now about what does it look like to, you know, call people into account. And here, the gardener's response to the tree that is not bearing proper fruit is to nurture the tree further rather than to pull out the axe. So it's interesting that the first move is not a move of, I'm done with you, I want to get rid of you, but like, how can I help you see? Like, how can I find ways to till your soil until you produce the kinds of fruit of the kingdom? Mm-hmm. So I think that smooths a little bit or mitigates some of the problems, but this text is not very hopeful that that's actually going to work, right? So there's still an axe. And Jesus is saying, I wish I could, you know, I wish I could turn you around. I wish I could, you know, put you under my wings and tell you I love you, but you're not going to let me do that. And so at the end of the day, this isn't going to end well. But it's not because I haven't tried to make it end well. It's because there are limits to how much I can nurture you before, you know, you can't let injustice go on indefinitely. At some point, you have to step in.
Yeah.
All right, Amy, so next week we're going to be in Luke chapter 15, verses 1 to 32, which are the parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son. Those are three really fun stories, so I'm looking forward to that one.
Sounds good to me.
All right, I'll see you then.
All right, bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are so grateful to all of our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us next week when we'll be discussing Luke 15, 1 to 32, the parables of the lost sheep, lost coin, and lost son. Until then, keep on digging.